Good evening. I'm Jim Zirin, and you are watching The Digital Age. Our show tonight is about America's influence in the world. Is it gaining or is it in decline? With us tonight, we have a great guest. It is James Lindsay. Jim Lindsay is the Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, who specializes in the domestic political aspects of foreign policy. Jim, we're delighted to have you with us.
Thanks for having me here, Jim.
Now, you come on a day where we're seeing a shutdown in the federal government, and we are looking forward a couple of weeks to a possible impasse on raising the debt ceiling, which should have profound impact on the U.S. economy. Do you feel that these issues reflect badly on us in the world?
Oh, certainly they do, Jim. And I think if you look at the reaction in foreign capitals, you're seeing a lot of what the Germans called Schadenfreude, that is, people taking delight at the misfortune of the United States. In some capitals, it's because they've been tired over the years of having American presidents and secretaries of state and diplomats come in and lecture them. But while there's Schadenfreude going on, I think there's also a great deal of concern, especially among our allies, about what this means for the future of American influence, to what extent the President of the United States will be distracted, focusing on internal problems, being hamstrung by internal divisions. He won't be able to bring full attention of the United States government to the issues that they're worried about.
Well, we've seen during the past month, kind of a month of President Obama's discontents with what appeared to be indecisiveness over Syria, having the Russians ride to the rescue. The situation with Iran culminating in what may be a diplomatic breakthrough, or going back even further, the Snowden affair. How do you feel all these elements might interact to weaken U.S. primacy in the world?
Well, it's been certainly been a turbulent series of months, and it reflects sort of the increasingly complicated nature of foreign policy. And when you look at a globalized world where things become more interconnected, one of the consequences of that are issues that you never dreamed about 10, 20, 30 years ago all of a sudden become important. Let's take the issue of Edward Snowden and his sort of data dump on things he pilfered from the National Security Agency. That's had very real consequences on a whole number of dimensions. And one of the things it's done will have a long-term impact. It is going to increase the pressure from other countries to try to construct the internet in a way that lessens the influence of the United States. We now have an internet that is free and global and open, but it doesn't have to be that way. And there's been pressure from countries, think China, think Russia, to really sort of rethink the basis of the internet. To have
Iran as well.
And what we're seeing is in countries that were sort of sitting on the fence, all of a sudden deeply worried about where American policy is going. I think of the Brazilians, the release of the information that the NSA had tracked what President Dilma Rousseff had been doing has caused a great deal of consternation in Brazil and really raised talk about how Brazil should work with other countries to develop fiber optic networks that don't go through the United States. And that can have very long-term consequences, not really for the specific issue of national security, but broader issues of economics. I mean, the growth of the internet has really made possible tremendous economic growth, and that economic vitality and dynamism may be up for grabs.
Well, when Hillary Clinton was a Secretary of State, she said one of the cornerstones of American foreign policy would be connectivity.
Correct.
A worldwide global internet. Now you see that receding in some sense?
It may, and that's really sort of what's at stake here. And again, there are competing visions of how the internet should operate. I mean, when you sort of think about the internet, it's quite remarkable. I mean, we're clear here in the United States how it's benefited us. We can go on in whatever hour and check the news and things like that. But it's also been a great stimulant to economic growth, not just here but abroad. I mean, there are wonderful stories about villages in India where local fishermen have been able to, by using their cell phone technology, find out the latest prices on the market for fish and know which port to bring their fish into to get the best price to increase their profits so they can reinvest in their own businesses. So a free and open internet has a real big impact for lots of people. But it's not clear that the sort of global free open internet what we sort of are used to today will persist.
And do you feel that a free and open internet benefits the United States in terms of its influence in the world?
Certainly. I mean, I think American foreign policy benefits from openness and transparency and economic growth. And clearly having an internet that promotes economic growth is in U.S. interest.
And if we balkanize the internet, if you will, that's certainly not in our interest.
Certainly not. I think Secretary Clinton was quite right to talk about the importance of connectivity. My employer, the Council on Foreign Relations, released a task force report last year about the internet, open, free internet. You can find it at CFR.org that I highly recommend to people because it really lays out these issues about how important the internet is in terms of economics and how it's in jeopardy by moves to try to balkanize the internet or sort of really reconstruct the way it operates.
Now, the Snowden affair would sort of influence other countries to balkanize the internet, as you put it. Would it not? Because people would be, nations would be worried about similar types of leaks and dumping and spying and the like.
Well, certainly it is, but I would sort of put it as more an excuse rather than a reason. I mean, the Chinese, the Russians, the Iranians have sort of been pushing for a different kind of internet, one that would be subject to international control. There was an effort last year to make the International Telecommunications Union become sort of the proprietor of the internet. The United States, Western countries sort of rolled that effort back. Clearly, the Snowden case has sort of given the Chinese, the Russians, the Iranians more ammunition to bring in their arguments for making the internet less susceptible to American influence. But it's not the reason why they've been doing it. I can assure you that the Chinese and the Russians and the Iranians carry out their own espionage activities. They're not shocked or surprised by any of this.
Do you think Snowden may have been a Chinese agent or perhaps a Russian agent?
I have no idea.
We have no information on that.
I have no information one way or the other.
Now, we also are seeing in our domestic polling that Obama's approval rating has plummeted recently. Do you think this unpopularity comes from his domestic policies or from his foreign policies?
Well, I wouldn't say they plummeted. I would say they've declined about 5 or 6 percentage points over the last several months. And one of the interesting things is if you look at foreign policy, the president is now below 50%. He only gets 49% approval for his handling of foreign policy. But that's actually the best news for the president on the polling front, on other issues like handling the budget deficit, health care. Handling Congress. His disapproval ratings are 5 or 6 points higher. But, of course, you always have to be careful when you look at polling results because it's a question you have to ask yourself is why is the president less popular in foreign policy, for example? The polls don't really tell you that. My guess is, and since I've spent a lot of time looking at the polls, is that it's really a mix of several things. You have have sort of conservatives who have been unhappy with the president for a long time, but then sort of the unfolding of the debate over Syria alarm many Democrats and independents as well because they're not enthusiastic about the president's renewed interest in military operations in Syria, and that sort of drove the president's approval ratings down.
Well, do you think it was a mistake of the president to have said he wants to go to Congress for approval, or is it kind of a master stroke of statesmanship and that he was playing for time because he anticipated the Russians would come in and help?
I don't know what the motivations were for the president to decide to go to Congress. It clearly, I think, hurt him politically. Because I think they anticipated that by going to Capitol Hill Congress would rally around the president. And while we didn't get to a vote, at least not yet, the way the debate unfolded, it became clear that the more the administration spoke about its operations or proposed operations in Syria, the less support the president had. And one of the dramatic things was there was no evidence that Democrats were going to rally behind their president. And typically in these sort of debates, the president's party may not like what the president wants to do, but they believe they have some solidarity, some obligation to the president to sort of fall in rank behind him. It became very clear that they were not having success in winning Democrats. And obviously for many Republicans who weren't inclined to do the president a favor in the first place, they certainly weren't going to come to his rescue.
And also polls showed that about 80% of the country were opposed to intervention.
Yeah, and which this is sort of the interesting thing. On Syria, the president had earned a lot of criticism over the past 18 months from neoconservatives, from more hawkish members of the political spectrum who wanted him to do much more on Syria, typically to argue that the administration should arm proxy forces in Syria. There were some who were talking about direct American intervention. President didn't do that, and he got very little criticism from the broader American public because, again, if you look at the polls, the public appetite for another military intervention is very, very low. I mean, there's deep skepticism among Americans over the wisdom of military interventions, particularly in what they perceive to be civil wars. And I think that's clearly the residue of Afghanistan and Iraq.
Henry Lau, a professor at George Washington University, whom you know, writes that the issue of force in human affairs is not a problem to be eliminated, but a dilemma to be managed. Mm-hmm. And I assume you would agree with that. But do you think Obama successfully managed the issue of force?
Well, that's a tough question. And I think, you know, how one manages force depends upon context and the nature of the challenges. And let's sort of step back. I think it's pretty clear that when Barack Obama was elected president, his main message to the American public on foreign policy was, I'm going to wind down American military commitments abroad, active occupations abroad. That's really the message on Iraq, and the president kept his campaign promise, U.S. troops are out of Iraq. And given that, I think...
But not in Afghanistan. He said he'd get us out of Afghanistan, and then he surged the force.
Well, what is interesting, what he said during the campaign was that we were investing resources in Iraq, and we really should be looking at Afghanistan. And then he came in, and there was a sort of a mini surge when he first came in, and then later in 2009, the much larger surge. Now, we can argue back and forth about whether that was a wise thing to do, whether it was rolled out properly and what have you. But I think the president clearly sort of tried one last time in Afghanistan, but now we're clearly on the downside trajectory on that. But back to your original question about force. Force is a tool of international relations, but it's not the only tool, and it's not even necessarily the tool that's most effective. And I think that's the challenge the president faced in Syria. It's very easy to use American military force. The American military is supremely talented, supremely equipped, supremely well-led. The problem is, what are you trying to achieve in terms of your foreign policy objectives? Now, it's very easy to break regimes. We did it in Iraq. But the challenge for American foreign policy has always been, how do you build regimes? And we've discovered, not just in the last decade, but over the last 100 years, that it's very difficult for the United States to construct a functioning, effective, legitimate government elsewhere.
Now, Dean Acheson said that if we're to negotiate, we must negotiate from strength. And I guess John Kennedy said we must never negotiate from fear. But as you see our influence, particularly in the Middle East, waning because of some of the factors we've discussed, does that mean that the negotiations we're contemplating with the Syrians over chemicals and over the next year with Iran over their nuclear program, that we're not going to be able to engage them with the strong hand that we would like?
Well, I would again step back and say, certainly from the ability to play the military card, the United States remains the unrivaled superpower. The administration and the United States government is capable of inflicting tremendous military destruction on Iran and on Syria. So that sort of tool of influence still exists and will persist for quite a long time.
But we have to be believed for it to be an effective tool.
We have to be believed, but that sort of inheres in the nature of or the context of the issue. And I think in Iran, the credibility of an American military threat is probably higher than it is in the case of Syria, because in Syria, there's a real concern, obvious in the American public, about the wisdom of becoming embroiled in a civil war. The bigger challenge, though, in the Middle East is that American foreign policy historically has been much more successful when what it's seeking to do is change the foreign policy behavior of other countries. In instances where the United States has sought to reconstruct societies or influence issues within countries, we've been much less successful. And again, this is not a recent development. If you go back and look at the presidency of Woodrow Wilson 100 years ago, where the United States went into Mexico, went into Haiti, went into the Dominican Republic, went into Nicaragua, all on a mission to reconstruct governments and to build properly functioning societies, in several cases spent decades occupying those countries and didn't produce much at the end of the day. So this has been a perpetual problem in American foreign policy. And again, the challenge for the Obama administration right now is that in several of these countries, think Egypt, the issue isn't what we can negotiate with the Egyptians, it's what kind of Egypt are the Egyptians going to choose. We have very little leverage over that, and that's a challenge for this administration and any successor administration.
Well, for 35 years, we've been saying that there's going to be regime change in Iran, and we've tried to orchestrate regime change in Iran, and we haven't been successful. If anything, the regime has become much more obdurate over a period of time and much more antithetical to American interests. So is that another example of where we haven't succeeded with regime change?
Well, my more conservative colleagues would argue we haven't really tried that hard to produce regime change in Iran and that we should try a lot harder. But putting that issue aside, I think, you know, in Iran, what we're really seeing right now is sort of the great reveal. President Obama succeeded in rallying the international community to put tougher sanctions on the Iranians.
You think they've worked?
We're going to find out whether they've worked. Clearly, we have Prime Minister Rouhani came to New York last month now, and spoke about Iran's positions, clearly sending signals that the Iranians want to talk. We're going to have direct negotiations. We had a direct phone call, first one, I guess, in 34 years.
35 years.
35 years between the leaders of the two countries. So the signals are all positive, but we haven't gotten down to the tough part, which is, okay, nice words, what are you willing to do? And I think the Iranians clearly want some relief from international sanctions, but what we don't know is whether they're willing to pay the price that the U.S. government is going to insist upon. I think that price is likely to be fairly stiff.
Well, they have maintained absolutely that they have a right to enrich, and we have said that they cannot have a nuclear weapon. We haven't said that they can't be in a position where they could easily break out into a nuclear weapon in a short period of time. I would assume that any deal that's negotiated would have to be acceptable to Israel, and Israel said that they must dismantle completely their enrichment capability. So do you see any possible middle ground that the parties could agree on, given those positions?
Well, it's certainly possible to strike a deal. I mean, if you take what the both capitals have said, and again, keep in mind the Iranians have said they have no intention of developing a nuclear weapon. There's a fatwa against nuclear weapons issued by the...
Well, no one can find the fatwa, well, but...
But they have proclaimed this. So if you take them at their word, in theory... there's a deal that can be had there. What we don't know is whether, again, the Iranians are willing to match word with deed. I mean, it's very clear that Ronald Reagan's guidance will apply here from the U.S. side, which is trust but verify. And the question is going to come down at the end of the day, what are the Iranians willing to give up? What level of verification are they going to agree to? And how confident can the United States and America's allies, Israel, Gulf countries, our Western allies, be that those verification protocols are sustainable and binding? And so this is where we get into the details, and we're going to see. And I think it will take a while before this unfolds. And, of course, the great question lurking in the background is, how genuine is the Iranian offer? Are the Iranians really trying to find a way out of the box canyon they found themselves? or is this just a strategy play where they're buying time, so that they can proceed with their nuclear weapons program?
And that's what they did in 2005, 2006.
They've certainly done it before. And again, if you look at the history of international relations, there's lots of examples of countries being duplicitous. But by the same token, there's lots of historical examples of countries changing their policy because they decided it wasn't in their interest. What we're going to find out over the next several months is which one applies in the case of Iran.
Well, before all this, these fascinating things evolved, the administration was talking about a pivot or rebalancing,
yes,
where a pivot, to me anyway, means that you kind of give up one interest for another. Mm-hmm. And the pivot was to be toward Asia, where we would mm-hmm. focus our foreign policy on Asia. Do you think that the pivot has not come to pass, and that we're back again with the Middle East?
If you look at what's on the president's agenda these days, it's pretty clear that the pivot has been unpivoted. We pivoted back. In part, in some sense, it's the Middle East is the issue that will not let go. And I think, you know, if you sort of look at the whole rollout of the pivot, which the White House now likes to call rebalancing, the president really made a mistake of trumpeting what he was going to do without having any sort of particularly clear strategy for what they were going to do in Asia. And I think that had sort of the perverse effect of raising expectations in Asia as to what the United States was going to do, at the same time alarming our allies and friends in the Middle East because they're worried we're going to forget about them. And then there hasn't been the sort of delivery on the rebalance that people in Asia were expecting. And the president seems to keep coming back to the Middle East. When he spoke at the UN General Assembly last month, he only mentioned Asia tangentially. The Middle East has clearly eaten up a lot of the president's time. And so we'll see going forward whether the rebalance really sort of is sustained. I think one of the common questions raised in Washington for people who spend a lot of time looking at personnel is, who is the person in the administration who's really driving the rebalancing agenda? When you look at the first term for President Obama, you could identify several people who clearly were trying to work the rebalance issue. When you look at second term of Obama, it's hard to see who the players are. They're investing their time in Asia. Again, if you look at Secretary of State Kerry, he's been spending very large amounts of his time on working issues in the Middle East. I think that's likely to persist for months to come.
Well, Obama spoke in the Middle East, in his UN address, you're quite right, and he said the United States will at times work with governments that do not meet the highest international expectations but who work with us on our core interests. Mm-hmm. And he was referring to countries in the Middle East. Which countries do you think he was referring to?
I would imagine many of them. I mean, if you sort of look at countries throughout the Middle East, whether it's Saudi Arabia or Egypt, sort of the two that come to mind, are countries that don't have the same sort of political systems or values as the United States. Clearly, Egypt is trying to work in that direction, or was trying to work in that direction. And the sort of the dilemma that President Obama's speech pointed to is one that he faces and his predecessors faced, and that is we have values that we aspire to persuade others to pursue, but at the same time we have strategic interests, and they can come into conflict. And this has been the tension, particularly when we talk about Egypt, where the United States for many years overlooked the fact that Mr. Mubarak ran an authoritarian government. We did so because we thought there was a benefit to us and our allies, think Israel, in terms of stability in Egypt. And the argument all along was that that arrangement was not going to be stable over the long term. And the critics of U.S. policy, whether it was George H.W. Bush or Bill Clinton or George W. Bush or Barack Obama, pointed this difficulty out. We had the uprising in Egypt, but now Egypt has really struggled to find something to succeed the Mubarak government. And now we're sort of back to a form of Mubarakism in Egypt. And on these issues, the United States government is, in most cases, really more a spectator than a participant, because we don't have the leverage and the ability to steer politics within Egypt. And what happens in Egypt is going to be decided by the Egyptians.
Well, Jim Lindsay, this has been fascinating. I'm afraid it's all the time we have, but I have a question for you. Okay. Do you see us as stronger or weaker today as a result of these recent events we've been discussing?
Oh, I think the American strength persists, and I think proclamations of America's demise are overstated and exaggerated.
Yep. Jim Lindsay, thank you so much for coming by. And thank you for coming by. Tune in next week for more on the digital age. For the digital age, I'm Jim Zirin. Please visit our website at www.digitalage.org. Good night and all the best.